right, well, we've ended up with just one case on our 10:30 docket. I understand counsel have checked in, and if the clerk will please introduce counsel who will be arguing today.
May I please the court, Mr. Donald Pout, to argue for the appellate, and Mr. Gibson, to argue for the state.
All right, then we'll call Hoffman v. State. And Mr. Couch, you may begin.
Counsel, I'm here to convince the court that Mr. Hoffman needs a new trial. As you're aware, he was convicted of this murder and received a life sentence with no possibility of parole. The issue before the court is the significance of the DNA sample found on the purse that was supplied to the defense after the trial was over. I'd like to go through the three prongs of the test and then start talking about some of the evidence, because I believe the issue is the entire body of evidence needing to be addressed. Number one, the state failed to disclose to the defense the existence of the DNA on the purse that belonged to Ms. Shavers. Number two, whether it was exculpatory or impeachment evidence, and it's clear that it was exculpatory because the DNA excluded Mr. Hoffman from being involved with the purse. And number three, if disclosed, would it make any difference in the outcome of the trial? Or is it material enough to make a difference in the outcome of the trial? The case of Eggers, A-G-U-E-R-S, which is not in my brief, is a Supreme Court case, 427 U.S. at 109. Quote, usually determination concerning the materiality prong of Brady involves balancing the strength of the favorable evidence, which I would assume would be the DNA on the purse, against the evidence supporting the verdict. We must consider the entire body of evidence presented at trial. I'd like to talk about some of the facts of the case so we can consider the entire body. Lori Shriver, who was the crime scene person, testified that there was a violent struggle in the apartment. And this was shown by the fact that there were blood spatters on three walls of the apartment, which is pretty amazing. Either the person was beaten so severely that the blood spattered to three walls, or the struggle went to different parts of the apartment room, maybe accounting for the blood being on three walls. The mattress was out of place. The wall posters were askew, according to Ms. Shriver. And there were yellow stains on the walls, which they interpreted to be the pepper spray that apparently Ms. Shavers was using to defend herself. And that ended up on the walls, I believe it was three walls, and the carpet. I think it's interesting to note that when Mr. Hoffman was arrested in Dallas County, there was no indication that he had any pepper spray residue on him. I don't recall what happened to the clothing, but there was no notation or testimony about pepper spray being on his person. This happened. He was arrested the day after this incident, so that it's likely that if there was pepper spray all over the apartment, that part of it may have ended up on Mr. Hoffman, because he was probably the person she was aiming it at. So there's no pepper spray on Mr. Hoffman, or there was no testimony. Swabs were taken from the sink trap, the wallpaper stains, and some hair that was found in the hallway. In addition, there were many fingerprints taken, and none of the fingerprints were connected to Mr. Hoffman. The only DNA connecting Mr. Hoffman to Ms. Shaver's death was the DNA found under one of her fingernails and one of her hands. And that's the only connection in that room with Mr. Hoffman. There was no, with a struggle that violent, there should be an assumption that his DNA, his fingerprints, his hair would be in that room somewhere. But there was nothing connecting him other than that fingernail on her hand.
that pretty well pointed to him and no other individual in the world, didn't it not?
I'm sorry, say that.
That pretty well pointed to him and no other individual in the world, did it not?
The fingernail?
The DNA.
DNA. Yes, but that DNA could have ended up on her fingernail at a different location at a different time. Earlier in the day, there could have been an altercation or struggle between the two, I don't know. And that could account for the DNA being on the fingernail, but that could have happened somewhere else. That's why the point of the defense was that there was such a violent struggle that something of Mr. Hoffman's body should have been in that room, on the mattress, on the hair, but there was nothing.
Okay, but the real issue is, was the evidence that was not disclosed material? That's really what it boils down to.
Right, absolutely.
And there was plenty of other opportunity for defense counsel to argue there's other DNA, there's fingerprints, there's this, there's that. None of that connects this defendant to this apartment. This missing evidence was simply cumulative of the other evidence that he did have to make that argument with, was it not?
I don't agree with that. I believe that the person who killed Miss Shavers is the person who also shook out the purse in the bedroom. There's two offenses, the murder and then there's a theft. The theft possibly could have happened before the murder if she came upon somebody shaking out her purse and then there was an altercation and she was killed, or she was killed and then the purse was dumped on the bed after the fact. I have never dumped out a purse personally before, but my wife has, and I've seen it on TV, and it's, in this case, it's probably have been a violent shaking to get the contents out, find money or drugs or keys or whatever. So if his DNA was not on that purse, it was somebody else's DNA. The person who...
That is, if you assume that there's only one male contributor to that DNA. If you assume that there was more than one male contributor to that DNA, it didn't exclude Mr. Hoffman, did it?
According to what I read, he was excluded from... His DNA was not on that purse.
But Ms. Van Winkle testified if there's more than one male contributor, you could not say that DNA excluded him. You don't recall that testimony?
Yes, I do. I remember that. But my point is, whoever shook out the purse is also the person who killed Ms. Shavers. It makes sense to me. Kelly Bocher, the trace examiner, testified that not all the materials that she gathered were tested. If there's a new trial granted, then the defense can ask that the DNA on the purse be compared to the evidence that was not tested, have it tested, and then compare it. The state's 63A, which was the vulvar sperm fraction, which was present, did not come from the defendant or the victim, or the appellant or the victim. Homicide Detective Bolcher testified that other unidentified DNA contributors found on Shaver's body were never identified. The DNA on the purse could now be compared to 63A, which I put in my brief, could be compared to the other materials that were taken but not tested.
Really consider that in deciding whether there was a Brady violation, can we?
Well, I guess the consideration is, that, is it material and would it affect the outcome? If a new trial was granted, then the defense could ask that the DNA on the purse be now compared to things that were not tested and to the sperm fraction. With that result, that a jury could have said there's a reasonable doubt here because the purse did not contain his DNA, and in light of the facts of what happened, or we think happened in the apartment, that very well could have resulted in the acquittal. Further, Miss Shavers said that if she was murdered, it would have been at the hands of Mr. Grimes, and Mr. Grimes' DNA was excluded, or he was excluded. That doesn't mean that Mr. Grimes did not find somebody else to do what he couldn't do.
Are you talking about the letter that was found at the scene?
Right.
Was there any handwriting analysis done of that document?
Not that I know.
Okay.
I didn't see anything on the record. You know, the purse may have been an afterthought of the murder. I don't know, but the purse is a vital part of the case because anybody, if somebody had, Mr. Hoffman had killed her and then went for the purse, I'm sure it would have been an urgent need to get the purse dumped out and get out of there, and certainly his DNA would have been all over that purse. And we've already talked about the pepper spray not being, as far as we know, pepper spray was not on his person. Mr. Hoffman's in the penitentiary for life. He could never be released. And the only chance he has is this court. If this court doesn't grant him a new trial, then he'll never be released. So vital that you consider all the evidence and conclude that the state's failure to disclose that information may have resulted in an acquittal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Couch. Mr. Gibson.
May it please the court. So to constitute Brady evidence, again, just as a quick review, the suppressed item evidence has to be material. And here we have DNA evidence or testing that was not shown to the defense. And as Justice Gabriel pointed out, this is materiality is the only thing that's at issue here. And materiality is a term of art. The question this court has to answer is, had these tests been disclosed, is there a reasonable probability that the outcome of the trial would have been different? We think that it's not, and it wasn't material. Now, we're dealing with three separate items here. Defense counsel was concentrating mainly on the purse, and so will I, but just as an aside, let me mention that Exhibits 81 and 82 were the inside and the outside and inside of a card holder, respectively. These tests are hardly even exculpatory, much less material, because no conclusion was made about the DNA contributors that were on this card holder, as they called it, at trial. Certainly, appellant couldn't be excluded from that. So now, putting that aside, we come to the purse, which was not, it's certainly not the slam dunk that appellant makes it out to be now, because it was more or less kind of a partial amount of the male DNA. Now, of course, the primary contributor was the victim, who was a female. But there was DNA, or only 4 out of 17 of the alleles, or the locations, had samples that could be taken that were on the Y chromosome. Now, as was pointed out, Ms. Van Winkle came to the conclusion, she was the one who tested this, came to the conclusion that if only one male was contributing to this, then appellant would have to be excluded. But she freely admitted that there was nothing compelling about that assumption. And it seems from her testimony, and she only mentioned this once, but it was something of a normative choice on her part. It was kind of like erring on the side of caution. In my view, I don't think there's anything that's scientifically compelled about that assumption, and maybe not even common sense. For example, a purse, it's not like finding semen inside of a dead victim. I mean, this is a purse that's out in public and people are touching it, it's running into things. There's more opportunity for contact DNA to be made by more than one person, more than one male even. But she testified that the opposite assumption, that more than one male contributed to this DNA, was equally valid. So with that assumption, she said, no conclusion could be made about whether appellant could be excluded. But even so, what would that exclusion tell us? It might say that maybe he didn't touch her purse, but the assumption that the defense is making now is that this was obviously, whoever touched that purse was obviously stealing something. Well, first of all, I don't remember there was any clear evidence of a theft. It could have been, just like counsel's wife, the victim in this case could have dumped the purse out on her own bed. Remember, that was in the master bedroom. These are in two different places. She was raped and murdered in her son's room. The purse was found in the master bedroom. And it was dumped out. It's possible that that appellant could have gone through that, and it's also possible that he could have left DNA, or maybe not. Contact DNA is such an iffy kind of thing to deal with anyway. But
maybe she dumped it out to get the pepper spray.
That's possible, too. I mean, there are lots of possibilities. But I think what this all comes down to, the point is that we can't look at even exculpatory evidence in kind of a vacuum when trying to determine materiality. It has to be placed in the context of the other evidence at trial, what the defense strategy was. And as was pointed out, the defense strategy was, hey, there's nothing connecting him to this house. There's nothing showing he was in the master bedroom or the kitchen or the room where this happened. And so in that sense, definitely anything that would show, well, he didn't touch a purse would be cumulative, because that's certainly sort of a lesser quality of compelling evidence, let's say, than simply just the fact that there's no evidence that he was in the house. Now, but the most important thing is, and we can't lose sight of this, is that, you know, maybe he wasn't in that master bedroom, but he was definitely with the victim during a struggle, the result of which was DNA under her fingernails, which belonged indisputably to the appellant. And I should point out, too, that that's not all we have. In a very nice little bookend, when we have the appellant picked up a few hours later, he's got scratches and what looks suspiciously like fingernail marks in his arms. I believe it was his arm. And obviously, given the fact that he's been scratched by her, clearly, and no one can really dispute that because his DNA is right there. Even if we could say that he was excluded from this purse, it's not like it's being excluded from her. And one of the few cases that deals with DNA evidence in a Brady context, this coincidentally named Hoffman case from Florida that we cite in our brief, kind of almost the opposite situation, where the DNA evidence that wasn't turned over was a clump of hair that was actually found in the victim's hand. Now, here we have the clump of hair, or you know, the skin cells under her fingernails are actually from the defendant. But of course, if we hadn't turned over something that excluded him from what looks like a struggle, say for example, if the DNA under the fingernails didn't belong to him, I think we'd have a lot harder problem defending that. But here we're at worst, we didn't turn over evidence that he might have been excluded from a purse that was contact DNA that was found in another room, a room different from the one in which she was killed. Finally, I just want to say that this materiality standard, again, it goes to whether there's a reasonable probability that the outcome of the trial would have been different. And in that sense, when you consider all the evidence together, the fingernail evidence, the fact that he's been scratched, and the fact that that what this evidence represents would be nothing more than just sort of accumulation of what the defense was trying to argue, we would say that the outcome of the trial wouldn't have been different. And let me emphasize again that, and I've been sort of assuming the worst, but let me say that the other assumption is that, well, maybe he wasn't even excluded from this. If, as I argued before, it's more of a common sense thing that maybe there were two contributors to this male DNA, then certainly it's not material. It's probably not even exculpatory. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. Mr. Capt, rebuttal.
I just want to reiterate that the DNA on the purse that doesn't belong to my client would be one more factor to give to the jury in the deliberations. And when you compare that with the fact that there was no evidence he was in the room, many of the exhibits were not tested. We still have the vulvar sperm fractions in State's Exhibit 63A, showing it didn't come from either the appellant or the victim. All these are presented to the jury, and in this case, if we had a new trial, the additional evidence on the purse that we say excludes Mr. Huffman from being present most likely would have resulted in the jury having to find that there was a reasonable doubt. And then considering the entire evidence of the case, I think the court should conclude that Mr. Huffman should be granted a new trial, and that the I know Fred Cummings and his son tried this case. I know they're very good lawyers, and I think if that evidence had been in their hands at the time of trial, they could have convinced the jury that this person did not commit this murder. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaut. Mr. Gibson, thank you all for being here. We appreciate your briefing and your oral arguments today. Your case is now submitted. That being our only case on our 10:30 docket, if we'll adjourn court, please.
All right.